Good afternoon. I should say, first of all, I'm not a specialist in Shub or in Soviet cinema. But I rather like the first remark that Esther just made about the difficulty of identifying Shub's creative personality or whatever, because in looking at the film that we're going to look at now, I have a feeling that we're talking about a different director, a different filmmaker. And I leave it to you to wonder how much this is due to the fact that this is, in fact, a synchronous sound documentary. But let me begin with the question of the title. Michael's been referring to it as Komsomol. No. The title, as it appears at the beginning of the film, is an acrostic in Russian, K-she-e, which stands for Komsomol Chef Elektrifikatsiya, which means Komsomol Patron of Electrification. So it's an acrostic. And of course, Komsomol itself is an acrostic. It's the Communist Youth League, but I'm not going to attempt to pronounce or remember what it actually stands for, because I can't remember, because I'm not a Russian speaker. Okay. So this is a forgotten film about the electrification of the Soviet Union, completed in 1932. At the time that I discovered it in Stanley Forman's archive at ETV, all I knew of Shub's work was Fall of the Romanov Dynasty. And this film is completely different. It's not a compilation film. It's a beautifully shot documentary with sync, location, sound practically throughout, and no commentary. 3 years before Housing Problems, which all the history books declare to be the first documentary with synchronous interviews. Okay, everyone who loves working in archives dreams of discovering something momentous. As Derrida said, the archive is a place where things get lost, a place of promise where things get lost. So finding this film was, for me, the fulfillment of such a dream. And it seemed to me to change the history of documentary. I want to recall the discovery because the owner of the archive, Stanley Forman, didn't know that he had it. ETV operated as the documentary distribution library of the British Communist Party, and many of the films that he had arrived from the embassies of the Soviet bloc via the diplomatic bag. And in this case, the film arrived in that way and was wrongly catalogued. It had been written down on the can and on his index cards as KME in English letters, instead of transcribing the Russian, which means that it wasn't catalogued by Stanley because Stanley spoke Russian. So he wouldn't have made that error. I was engaged in compiling Stanley's catalogue into a database. And his index cards only recorded titles and subjects and not directors. Since the title puzzled us, we pulled the film cans down from the shelves to take a look, and lo and behold, a pristine 35mm print, which looked like it had never been watched, never been shown, never been screened, even on a Steenbeck, and with a handwritten note as we opened the can, of the date that it had been received, which was 1977, if I remember correctly. I sat down at the Steenbeck with a colleague who was working with me, who was Russian-speaking, who read out the titles as the film ran. And when I saw author of the film, Esfir Shub, obviously I jumped with astonishment. The first thing that struck me was the film's extraordinary qualities as a documentary. The dynamic style of the cinematography, the extensive use of music, much of which was in sync, especially the editing, Schubes Messier, which constructed the film's narrative without recourse to any kind of soundtrack commentary, just set up at the beginning by a few titles explaining one or two things about where we are, what we're going to see. Okay, so this turns out not only to be one of the first Soviet sound documentaries, the other main examples obviously being Vertov's Enthusiasm and Three Songs of Lenin, but I think it adopts a signal position in the debate that was initiated by the famous statement on sound by Eisenstein, Pudovkin and Alexandrov. To summarize, Eisenstein feared that sound would proceed on a naturalistic level, that it would be just doubling the action on the screen, compacting an illusion of people talking, audible objects and the rest, and that this would destroy montage. So he argued for sound to be taken up as a new element of montage and to be treated separately to the image. Although Vertov criticized the statement as being too schematic, Enthusiasm, subtitled Symphony of the Donbass, sad to think that that's exactly where the conflict in the Ukraine is going on at this moment, Symphony of the Donbass, he took precisely the contrapuntal approach advocated by Eisenstein. To supplement his portrait of the coal miners of the Don Basin, 4 years into the first five-year plan, Vertov built a soundtrack out of the quote, who am I quoting? I'm quoting Sadul, I think. The clash of hammers, of train whistles, and the songs of workers at rest, recorded on location in the mines and villages visited by the camera, and Sadul, writing in France after the Second World War, described it as edited as freely as he cut visuals, creating a kind of musique concrète. One of those whose ears were captured by the film at a screening at the London Film Society was Charles Chaplin, who wrote that he would, quote, never have believed it possible to assemble mechanical noises to create such beauty, one of the most superb symphonies I have known, unquote. In Schubes's film, however, apart from some beautifully constructed montage sequences, the sound is synchronous and full of people talking, audible objects, and the rest, but without, I think, justifying Eisenstein's fear. Schubes is far too good an editor. Far from destroying montage, the film deploys a whole variety of montage techniques, including various types that were adumbrated by Eisenstein, all bound together by the communist discourse of the film's various speakers. Schubes's approach had another benefit. It meant that she could not be accused of the tendency known in Soviet communist discourse of the day as formalism, which was attacked especially by the proletcult movement. On the contrary, her approach is both experimental and eminently realist. The claim about housing problems is in any case misleading, because it's generally presented in the too narrow context of national cinema, omitting to mention experiments going on elsewhere. France, for example, where Marcel Pagnol began making features with location sound recording to bring regional speech to the screen. And in the same year as housing problems, Jean Renoir, also on location in the south of France, shot Tony, 1935, with synchronous dialogue and an extraordinary example of neorealism avant la lettre. In Germany, meanwhile, Leni Riefenstahl had all the resources she needed to shoot location sound at the Nuremberg Rally in 1934, although the technology wasn't quite up to it, and she had to reshoot speeches by Rudolf Hess and others back in Berlin. In Russia, the technology of sound had not been included in the first five-year plan, but Stalin sent Eisenstein and the others to Hollywood to investigate. The statement on sound is a call for an aesthetic which is effectively anti-Stalinist. But there was another problem. The trouble was that the sound system developed, adopted by Hollywood, more or less universally adopted, but not quite everywhere, was designed for studio shooting. Which is one of the main reasons why it took so long for documentary to adopt synchronous sound. very few such films before the Second World War. Back in the Soviet Union, Vertov had put in a bid for a sound system better suited to location filming. This was the Shorin system that Shub credits at the start of this film. The film begins with a strange new electrical instrument, the theremin, named after its Russian inventor, whose eerie ethereal tones were later introduced into Hollywood by Bernard Herrmann. And more recently, it can be seen playing in Lucrezia Martel's La Niña Santa through a shop window, if anybody's seen that. A caption announces, "Overture at the Moscow Sound Factory," and we find ourselves in a recording studio, filming picture and sound together. The scene propels us musically into modernity and announces the film's main theme. Synchronous sound equals the advance of electricity, equals the construction of the new society and a new culture. The metaphor is then extended to take in other exemplary sites of modern communications, like a telephone exchange and a radio station, which introduces a secondary theme for the various different languages that we hear being spoken signal internationalism. The work of montage presents us with the international character of the modern world in industrial technology to which the Soviet Revolution aspired, with the internationalism of the communist movement woven in, so to speak. But take note, the film was made at a problematic moment for internationalist principles within the Soviet Union, in which Stalin, who promoted the heretical idea of socialism in one country, was still in the process of consolidating his power. I'll come back to that. Now, there's a puzzle here as well. In the film we discovered, we get a succession of scenes in different languages without translation. The film opens with a few minimally worded captions, as I said, but then there are no other captions until we get to the opening of the Dnieprostroy Dam towards the end. No subtitles, which even in the West was still at an experimental stage, so we must suppose that this is as Shub intended. Certainly I'd like to think so, because that would strengthen the metaphor of internationalism. What matters only is that the Russian public would recognize foreign languages being spoken. For example, in the scene towards the end of the film, below the new dam of Dnieprostroy, just before the opening ceremony, with a bunch of Americans relaxing and playing jazz on a wind-up gramophone. They're not identified, but the audience would have been easily able to recognize them as the Americans whom they knew were assisting in the electrification plan. Again, I'll come back to that. Shub's treatment of music is integral and realist. I mean, after filming in an orchestra in a studio with the new sound cameras, Popov's splendid score, more like Prokofiev than Shostakovich, alternates with popular and folk musics from different regions. There are dance performances with synchronous music. A revolutionary ballet is performed for the workers on the factory floor by three energetic male dancers accompanied by a single accordion. In another sequence, a boy dances gracefully to drums and pipes. A band of traditional brass instruments performs revolutionary marches. This varied musical discourse seems to promise that the new society will be inclusive, and I'm reminded of Adorno's remark that music's anthropological function, that of bringing communities together, which is exactly like Humphrey Jennings' Listen to Britain 10 years later or so. The music interweaves with three paradigmatic types of speech. People speaking at public events, individuals speaking to the camera, and the sound of scenes which the camera is observing, like the telephone exchange switchboard operators. No commentary and almost no floating voiceovers. Everyone in the film who speaks is seen, and most of them are named. Visually, the film not only displays a virtuoso artistry, but pays homage in doing so to the visual styles of both Eisenstein and Vertov, but more to Vertov, I think, as in the shots of and by a cameraman placed in a basket hanging from the crane in the scene with the Americans, which Shub happily borrows from Man with a Movie Camera. The lucid exposition uses a form of indirect narration divided between a variety of speakers in front of us, individuals speaking to camera, others addressing political meetings. Bachtin would call these different speech genres. Wittgenstein would say different language games. In any case, not the conventional official spokesperson type, but working people and party members, both men and women, involved in the activities portrayed. A credit at the start of the film announces that the words are those of a well-known writer of the day, Marietta Shaginian, the author of a book about the construction of a hydroelectric power station in Armenia. Exactly how this worked, I don't know, but there are signs in the filming that some of the speech is not spontaneous, that is, not exactly interviews, but little rehearsed speeches, which is also like housing problems. In other words, there are moments when an individual speaker seems to feel a bit awkward and isn't quite sure whether they should be speaking to the camera or somebody in the film crew. And this serves as a reminder that speaking spontaneously to a movie camera is not a natural form of behavior, but a new kind of language game which has to be learned or to become culturally ingrained so that it comes to be second nature. But there are also scenes of political meetings at various workplaces where speakers are addressing a group, and given that political meetings are situations where people prepare what they're going to say, they seem to me to be speaking in their own words as proud members of a new political culture which the film celebrates along with electrification and progress at a moment when the revolution has not yet fully fallen into Stalinist totalitarianism. I see this as a film in which propaganda and artistic experiment are still combined in a constructivist spirit, pointing way beyond the norms of documentary narrative in the 1930s. I don't recall any other film of the time quite like it. A precocious film, it's tempting to say that it's stylistically ahead of its time, except you could also turn the question around and ask a counterfactual question about the evolution of documentary conventions. How might documentary have developed if it had not been subject to the demands of propaganda, and I don't just mean in the Soviet Union, with its insistence on spelling out the message in an authoritative and sometimes authoritarian commentary voice? The Grierson Film Unit fought against this with small experiments involving poetry and declamatory delivery. What you get here is a very different approach, a lost paradigm of a dialogical form of narration which renders the voice of the commentary unnecessary and respects the viewer's intelligence, a form of construction which, with rare exceptions, disappears quickly, so that 30-odd years later, in the 1960s, when the conditions ripen, it's invented afresh in entirely new circumstances. There is another reason why the film fascinates me. It became a primary exhibit in my own film, The American Who Electrified Russia, whose subject is Solomon Trone, my grandmother's first cousin, born in 1872, who was a central figure in the Soviet electrification plan announced by Lenin in 1920, which Shub's film celebrates. Trone was a paradoxical figure, a lifelong Marxist, an electrical engineer by training, a revolutionary in 1905, when he narrowly escaped being shot on Bloody Sunday, who around 1912 became managing director of General Electric Russia, and then went to work for International General Electric in New York and Berlin. Whatever you want to call it, concludes with the inauguration in 1932 of Dniprostroy, the hydroelectric power station on the River Dnieper, which was the centerpiece of the Soviet electrification plan, and Trone was its technical designer. His name doesn't figure in the history books, however, partly because he himself always remained in the background, and partly because of the nature of General Electric's involvement. This is how I know the backstory, as it were, of Shub's film. The involvement of General Electric was well enough known at the time. There were reports about it in the Wall Street Journal, for example, and in Russia, Americanism was all the rage. The Soviet Revolution was strongly focused on emulating the industrial development of the USA and adopting the latest technologies. They had Ford's own architect build them a factory for producing tractors, in honor of which Russians started calling their sons Fordson. Lenin himself, of course, argued in favor of scientific management and described the revolution as agitation, education, and electrification. By the way, we now know from further researches by our archivist on the film, David Evans in Canada, that extraordinary as this sounds, GE and US banking interests began negotiating with the Bolsheviks prior to the October Revolution. And the head of GE at the time, one Gerard Swope, went to St. Petersburg to negotiate with the revolutionary government before the end of 1917. But in subsequent years, with the rise of Stalin and then the coming of the Cold War, General Electric's involvement was something which neither the Russians nor the Americans cared to be known. And the relationship wasn't just forgotten, but repressed. Yet it becomes very clear from Shub's film that they were indeed involved. A woman factory worker and Komsomol member talks about working on an American production line and even beating the American production records. There's a short scene on a shop floor with an American engineer giving advice. We haven't been able to identify him, but we know that the American called Cooper, who gives a speech at the opening ceremony towards the end of the film, was Colonel Hugh Cooper, an employee of General Electric, and a hydro engineer whom they put in charge of construction. He was described by the Wall Street Journal in 1926 as, quote, an engineer and businessman not to be suspected of any tinge of pinkness in his mental processes, unquote. And then there's that bunch of Americans, men and women, relaxing on the beach below the dam just before the ceremony. In short, General Electric isn't named in the film, but it's there. And this presents a political conundrum, because it's connected with another forgotten item of history from the year before Shub's film. This was the Prompartii trial, one of the first of the Stalinist show trials, 5 years before the first big show trials of 1936. The Prompartii, or Industrial Party, was an invented name. No such thing existed. The defendants, including a number of foreigners, were accused of sabotage, and several were sentenced to internal exile, although the alleged ringleader was subsequently rehabilitated. Some of the defendants were well known to Trone, who obtained a press pass to attend the trial. A photo published in the New York Times shows him sitting in the press gallery. And in fact, the trial was a very high-profile event, which was broadcast live on radio and also filmed. We were able to include some footage of the trial in the film that I made. Nevertheless, the following year, Shub makes a film about the electrification in which the Americans are present, although General Electric isn't itself ever named. The claim I want to make about this film is that it's not only a wonderful rediscovery as a film, it also serves as primary historical evidence of a forgotten but significant episode. One puzzle remains. Why did somebody in the Soviet Union strike a fresh print of the film in the 1970s and send it to Stanley Forman in London? Since he didn't know he had it, he couldn't explain. One final word. Because of the multiple languages, in the version which you're about to see now, this version was digitized by the BFI and with the help of various translators, I subtitled it. But following this notion that the film was not subtitled in its original release and that it contains this variety of languages, I've only subtitled the Russian.